Can everybody hear me if I don't use the mic? Because I'm going to be using the laptop and everything as well here.
Great.
So there's a little bit of confusion about the rooms. So this is not the how not to do FIPS 140 session, although in some ironic sense it actually is. So this is the side channel on Embedded. I just want to quickly do an intro so you have an idea of what company I work for, my background, so you have an idea who's talking to you today. We're basically a company that was is doing breaking of products, so we're hackers. But we don't just hack everything away, because that will keep us too busy, actually. So we need to restrict ourselves, so we restrict ourselves to the attacker business model, which basically means that we also use some common sense to what we should be attacking. So we look at what the assets are, what the protection mechanisms, and how we can break through those things. So we're usually working for customers in the finance space, pay TV space, mobile space, to assess the security of their devices. So we're very device focused. We do actually three things. One thing isn't here. So one thing is we test to break, so really just take an attacker's point of view and see where we can get. The other thing we do is we certify for several industries. We're not a FIPS lab. We are becoming a common criteria lab, but we're already doing Invico and stuff for the pay TV industry. We also sell tools. So we also sell tools that do various kinds of attacks, like the side channel attacks and the fault injection attacks. Now, my goal of today is not to sell you the tools. I mean, it'd be nice if you buy a few, but the goal is really to bring the concepts across. And I'll be using our tools, obviously, but I'm not specifically talking about the tools. I'm speaking about the methods and techniques and analysis. So this is me. I already had a quick intro there. So I'm the CTO for Riscue North America. And we actually have two offices, one in the Netherlands and one here in the US in San Francisco. My personal background is in computer science and artificial intelligence, but I rolled into security and with Riscue into side channel analysis about 10 years ago now. It's making me sound old. Anyway. So here's a quick overview of what I'll be doing this morning. So we have about 3 hours, which is in terms of bringing across side channel attacks, scratching the surface. I think we do like 5-day trainings of this stuff as well. So what I really want to focus on is the practical side. The math side, you can all look up in papers and online, and there's a lot of interesting reads out there. What I really want to focus on is just showing you how this stuff works in practice. So we have a demo board here set up. I'll get into the details of that later. It's a small embedded device with some crypto in it. So I'll start actually off with doing the demo, so you get a feel for what we're talking about the rest of the morning. Then I'll go into more of an introduction into side channel analysis. I'll do a demo acquisition, so getting the data from the device. I'll make a session on TVLA, which is a more recent way of detecting leakage. So I'll get into the subtleties of what the difference is between detecting leakage or actually extracting key material from a device. Then we'll have a short session on signal processing, which is actually a very important part of side channel analysis. I'll do a demo as well on actually extracting the key. And then I'll end off with some countermeasures that that are public and that you can use to, I wouldn't say prevent, but at least raise the bar for your products when it comes to side channel. Feel free to ask me questions at any time. We're not with a huge group here, so we can keep it a bit interactive. So you don't have to listen to me either all morning. So I want to focus mainly on two things. So really the basics, which is mostly a time constraint. And I want to just demo leakage detection and how quickly you can do leakage detection versus key extraction. So those are two subtly different things. let's just dive right in. So I have a board set up here. Hope you don't mind if I sit down because I gotta push some buttons here. So this board, actually what it does is it's we send it a plain text, 16 bytes of plain text. It will encrypt it with AES-128 and it will return us a ciphertext. And I'm not supposed to know the key that's in there. So that's what it's doing. Now this is a board in a test environment. So one thing that the board also does, it tells me when the crypto is active. So that's basically the information I know. So I know what's the plain text, because I'm sending it. What's the ciphertext, because I'm getting it back. And when is the crypto active, which I'm seeing through a hardware trigger. So what I can do now is I have here the board itself. You can come later and check this all out. But I basically have the board there. This cube that's standing up straight is an electromagnetic probe, which is a fancy word for saying there's a coil that I put over the chip. And then I have a oscilloscope here, which senses the change in magnetic field. And I have a bunch of software that can show what's going on and that drives the whole operation here. So I'm going to start off with, let's close this for a second, an acquisition. So these are just the software controls. I'll skip the details for now. Basically, I need to configure my oscilloscope and I need to configure my target. I'll give it a start. What you're seeing here is kind of a live capture of what's going on the chip, at least what's going on in the electromagnetic field around the chip. Does anybody see something there that they find interesting, just from looking at this plot itself? Go ahead.
It's periodic.
It's periodic, yeah. So you see there's some kind of repetition. What does that tell you? Here rounds, yeah. So AES, actually, I think all cryptographic algorithms I know of are periodic. They have rounds or they repeat some operation many times. I mentioned this was AES-128. So of course you're all thinking, oh, that's 10 rounds. If you count the periods there, you see about 10 of these repetitions. So this tells us a few things. First of all, it's a soft confirmation that it is actually what AES-128 we're looking at. Always good to check. We're also seeing that we can actually observe this kind of behavior on the chip itself. And who here has actual practical experience with doing side channel analysis? Okay, so I see one. So one thing that you may also recognize is that this is a very noisy system. So when you do this in practice, when you see this, you're almost already done. And of course that is on purpose because we only have a couple hours, so I'm not going to bring a system in here which takes me 3 weeks to crack because you would be really bored. So this is a software implementation of AES. So there's a CPU on the card, which is just doing it's 32-bit ARM, I believe, which is just executing an AES software implementation. But all the techniques I'm talking about today can apply this as well to hardware crypto engines. It just takes typically a bit longer time to analyze them, because instead of here, this scale is about 225 microseconds. I've seen SoCs that run at, I don't know, gigahertz or something, and they're doing one full AES round per clock tick. So you're looking at 10 nanoseconds, 15 nanoseconds, maybe. So then you get really into the needle in the haystack kind of problems. But this one is nice and obvious. So I've, while I'm chatting away, I'm actually acquiring some traces. I think this is good enough now. Let's stop it. So obviously what I want to know in this case at least, I'm going to pretend I'm a lab, I'm not an attacker. So I want to know, does this thing actually leak its crypto key? Because right now we only see rounds. Rounds don't mean that I can extract a key yet. It's a good indicator that you know that you're acquiring at the right time, but it's not the information you're looking for yet. So I actually need to do a little bit of processing, which I'll get into later as well, because this is an EM signal. And EM is actually the derivative of the power signal, which means that I, at least for the mathematicians here, I need to do an integration of this signal. But I won't. I'm going to do something really dirty, which is just take the absolute value and then low pass it a bit. And that's basically because you get some really weird, you amplify low frequent noise when you do an actual integration. I don't have a problem with this. So this is just software. So as you can see, the signal here went above and below the 0 volt. I just took the absolute value of everything. And this is just a little bit of processing. Then one of the things I'm going to do is a low pass filter. And all these things will be entirely clear to you in 3 hours if I do my job right. Low pass filter. What this basically does is it takes more or less a moving average filter over the signals. So instead of all these spiky things, you get a much cleaner signal. So here you can already see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and I missed 10 rounds. Now, this is the signal processing part I was talking about. I can do one, well, let's see how lucky we are. Let's do the actual, where is it? Non-specific p-test, and this is the leakage detection that I was talking about earlier. So this is actually a statistical method that we're using, and it looks very good. What it does is I actually lied a little bit. So when I said I was sending it to random plain text, they weren't entirely random. So I've actually selected my plain text in a clever way that gives me a very significant, or it boosts any leakage that's going on in some of the middle rounds of this, this AES. So I've actually boosted the leakage in round 5 and 6, which allows me to detect it quite well. The detection goes by the Welch T test, which is the statistical test. The output is basically a value that's called T. And what I want to see is this value T increase with the number of traces that I take. So the more measurements I take, the higher T becomes, the more stronger my evidence is that there's actually something leaking. And you can see that in this evolution plot here at the bottom. So while I was chatting earlier, I got about 2800, 2900 encryptions with these associated traces. I've done a bunch of signal processing, and then I did the leakage detection. And what you can see is that, at least for this red line, it's going up. And even more so, it's over the black line, which is kind of the leakage threshold, above which we start saying, well, there's probably something going on. So this is actually the entire flow that I just demonstrated to you of capturing traces, doing a little bit of signal processing, and detecting that this thing is leaking or not. So obviously some prep work went into this, so I know some of the parameters that I need to set here, but this is typically a flow of a few days that I've compressed here. So it's really a quick way of detecting, is there a problem with this target, yes or no? And the next step could be, well, for us as a lab, usually when we see this, we're already done. We can go back to our client and say, well, you got something leaking. Some other clients who are more new in this field, they actually want to see their keys come out. So we have to do a little bit more work to actually do a key extraction, because remember I said in round 5 and 6, I boosted the leakage. That's something that an attacker cannot always do. So an attacker may have to work with random plain text, so you're not boosting leakage. So you need more traces in order to get the leakage out, which takes some more time, some more money on the client side as well. But if they're willing to pay for it, we'll go the extra mile. So I just wanted to give you this process as an overview. Now let's take each of these steps and dive a little bit deeper into what they mean and what the different things are that you can tweak here. Any questions so far?
So I'm just not understanding what T-Brain evolution, how does that relate to the signal that you collect?
Yeah, so what you can, I'll go into it later, but what you can understand for now, it's the outcome of a statistical test that says how much leakage there is. So if I see and how much leakage there is for a certain number of AES acquisitions I've done. So as the number of acquisitions grows, I get more and more statistical evidence for key material, and therefore my leakage grows. If I am...
Specifically when you say leakage, what exactly are you looking in the waveform?
I am looking for a relation between the intermediate data that is being processed by the algorithm and the EM signal I'm capturing. So if there's a link between the data it's processing, so AES, processing intermediate data and keys, if that's linked somehow to the traces that I'm taking, then there's potentially a problem. To show you, you can also mess this up. The leakage is actually in the middle rounds, in round 5 and 6. So I suspect if I run the t-test somewhere near the end, I shouldn't see any leakage, because this is not where round 5 and 6 happen. And here you see that this t-value actually doesn't even cross the 4.5 threshold. So there's no leakage in that part of the time domain. If I point it at round 5 and 6 again, I will start seeing the leakage. So that's how you, as a lab, can start deciding, hey, there's something here or there's not. Does that answer your question? Any other questions?
Yeah. In terms of the probe, do you have to know which part of the chip, or is it just any general area that you have to probe?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So the question is, can I just put the probe anywhere over the chip, or do you have to be over a specific part? The funny thing with this target is it doesn't matter so much. So this is a very fancy stage, which I can use to probe all kinds of different locations in an automated fashion. I'm just using it now as a holder for the EM probe. Actually, the board is loose on any yield. So I just centered it by hand. Now, once you start optimizing your attacks, or you're doing like key extraction, or you have larger SOCs, then you really have to start searching where to go on the chip. I'll get into that in a second as well. Any other questions? All right. So, back to basics. So what is a side channel? Well, the way we look at it is it's some unintended interface that you can use for either monitoring a device or operating it in some way that usually the manufacturers didn't think of. So for instance, here we have a pin terminal, a payment terminal. So you have all the normal intended interfaces like the screen and the keypad, all those the things that you're used to. But there's also some unintended interfaces. So for instance, this thing consumes power. Well, that's something we can measure. It's an unintended interface. It generates EM radiation. That's just the fact of any physical device that's consuming power will also radiate out electromagnetic waves. Interestingly, most devices also have a little bit of sound coming out of them. Usually when you look at the printed circuit board in these things, you have decoupling capacitors sitting around the chip. These actually vibrate. There was a paper, I think it was about a year ago, by Shamir, where they extracted an elliptic curve key from a PC by just having a microphone listen to the PC. So there's actually things vibrating that relate to the operations that are happening on the chip. So there can be this is just a few examples. There's tons of side channels that you don't always think about, that we even don't think about when we read about it and we think, oh, that's interesting. The weirdest one was actually last week where somebody, I don't know how they come up with this stuff, but they had a laptop, and they were doing side channel analysis on that laptop, so they were doing some crypto on it. They had I kid you not, they had a sausage attached to the laptop, and they were measuring, on the other end of the sausage, they were measuring the change of the ground potential. And that actually had enough information to get the key out of the laptop. I don't come up with this stuff. I have weird thoughts sometimes, but this one I had to read. So some examples of side channels. So time is an interesting one. So if a process takes a certain amount of time, and that relates to a secret, can be interesting. Power consumption, I talked about. EM, I talked about. Light is actually also a side channel. So when you open up a chip and you look at the silicon, at the die itself, there's actually, when transistors are switching, there's actually a small probability they emit a photon. And these photons you can capture. So you can actually kind of see what's going on the chip. It's another side channel. Sound, we talked about. Temperature is also a side channel. So active areas on a chip will heat up. Something you can measure. I don't know if you can extract crypto keys with it, but it's some information about what's going on. And that's just the passive side. So this afternoon I'll talk about fault injection. That's when you use these things in an active way. So I can also change the power supply to a chip, or I can send electromagnetic pulses. I can send light pulses. And I haven't heard of a chip getting confused by sound yet, but why not? Heating up. Anybody who's ever overclocked their PC knows that that when you heat things up, errors will start occurring. So that's also a channel for faults. So these are all side channels. So you can get some information out about a chip. But one of the interesting things, and you know, we're at the ISMC conference, so we're looking at crypto mainly. We can compromise secrets using these side channels. So that's also an important link to think about. So not every side channel allows you to compromise the system. But it's good to keep in mind. So we make a distinction between two types. One is the passive side channel analysis, what we'll be talking about this morning. So we're looking at all kinds of signals coming out of the system. And then this afternoon I'll talk about active side channels, fault injection, where we try to manipulate the behavior of a device in some specific way that that helps an attacker. Can anybody guess the movies?
12 Fingers on the Bottom.
Yeah. Do you know the top one, Bertan? I think it's Das Leben des Anderen, The Lives of Others, maybe?
German movie about GR.
Yeah, Das Leben des Anderen, right?
Yeah.
That was right. It's a German movie about listening into other people's lives, and I think it's about the I forgot what that agency was called in the DDR. What was that agency called again?
Stasi.
Yes. Yes.
Stasi.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, I've already shown you a little bit of the process, but this is at least theoretically what we do in our lab. So we take some traces, then we process them, then we detect leakage, and then we write a report, and then we're done. In theory, now. If you look at an attacker, they might substitute writing a report for actually the last step, which is extracting a key and profiting from that somehow. I still put in theory up there because in reality it's more of a process that goes left and right. So you'll start with some acquisition, but maybe after that you do some signal processing, you find out that your trace set is bad, so you go back to trace acquisition. Sorry for the slide, it's not that important really, but what I'm trying to show is this is not just a it's not a waterfall model. So there's a lot of loops and iterations, and often you're kind of flying in the dark. So you have to do a few steps before you can actually see some leakage, and then you know you're on the right trail, and you can backtrack a few steps, optimize some parameters, check again whether you still have leakage, and that way you work your way up, so to say. And then finally, you can do the key attack. So the terms I'll be using is acquisition, which is the process of actually talking to the target device. So it's just some basic communication that you need to set up, and obtaining the trace information, so the actual measurements. You have to align these traces. I didn't show that in the demo that I started off with, but I'll show you later what's going on. There might be some timing variation that messes up your traces, basically, that you need to fix. Then there's signal processing. So I showed you a little bit of the absolute and low pass filtering to make the signal stand out a bit clearer. There's a whole body of work of what you can do in signal processing. And then you come to actually confirming the crypto. And when I say location here, I can mean either the location spatially on the die when I'm doing an EM scan. I can also mean in time, when does it actually happen. And you usually use like the t-testing for it. So that t-value that increased, it's actually nice if you look at, say, you take 1,000 traces, you look at what the t-value is, and you tweak your parameters a little bit, or your processing, and you look whether that t-value goes up or down. And you actually know if you're generating more leakage or whether you're moving away from leakage. So it's a good indicator to help you keep on the right track. And then finally, you can attack the crypto and extract the keys. Any questions about this general flow? Okay, I shall move on. So I'll go into these topics one by one. So first, why do we actually have this these nice power traces that we can use? So first, something that I'd like that's an open door is semiconductors use power. We all know that. But actually, they're mostly consuming power when they're working, and that's caused by the fact that if transistors switch, not only do they emit beautiful photons, they also consume power. And that actually has to do with the fact that they're during very short times during the switching, there's some short circuits happening. And that actually gives you a power profile. So if you remember those nice graphs I was showing this morning from the acquisition, if you zoom really far into that picture, at some point you start seeing these kind of patterns. So you'll see a spike and it kind of dies out, and then another spike and it dies out. And it actually has to do with the clock on the device. So every time a CPU or whatever digital circuit takes the next step, it's on a clock edge. So there's this clock that says, okay, let's do the next step. At that moment, you get a lot of transistor switching. And by the end of the clock cycle, most have done their work, and it kind of dies out. So that's a very typical pattern that you see. So this just repeats for every clock cycle. Now, if you start looking at that from a little bit higher, or you zoom out a little bit, you don't look at the clock anymore, you see more of these process level graphs. This is actually an interesting example of many, many years ago, when these things were still quite vulnerable. This is a couple of traces that we took from a pin verification. So So this was running on a really broken smart card. Basically what you send it a PIN code, 4 digits, the card would then check whether that PIN was correct or not and unlock some functionality or do a payment transaction. I don't exactly remember what card it was. But we saw something interesting. So you may already recognize these 4 or 5 traces are not exactly the same. So what we actually did is PIN is 4 digits. And we, you know, as an attacker, we of course don't know the PIN, but we want to find out. So we send it different PINs. And we saw that actually in 1 out of 10 times, so for 9 out of 10 times we saw that first trace. And for about 1 in 10 times we saw that second trace, which is a little bit, I don't have a laser pointer unfortunately, but I have a mouse. So if you look at this bump, it only occurs once here, but it occurs twice here. And you also see that this large one has actually shifted a little bit. So there's something that happens 1 out of 10 times which increases the timing of this process. Now, when you look at the process, we found out that all the pins that we send at random that has an 8 starting had this effect. Now, that's actually a large problem. Because if I don't know the PIN code, I can just send 10 different PIN codes with a different first digit, and I can actually figure out what that first digit is. And it's actually an even worse problem, because once I've done that for the first digit, I can just redo it for all the other digits. So that's exactly what we did. And you see that with every digit that you get correct, this traces gets a little bit longer. So eventually you can just unfold the PIN code. So, do we have mathematicians here? How strong is your combinatorics? So normally you have 10,000 possibilities, right? 0000 to 9999. With this information, how many tries do I need at maximum? I'll take a sip of water while you ponder that question. So that's correct, because now I just need to send 10 PIN codes to figure out the first one, then 10 for the second, 10 for the third, and 10 for the fourth. So instead of 10,000 tries maximum, I now have 40 tries maximum, which is quite a reduction of your search space. Now, if you have a reasonable card, it will probably lock you out of three after 3 attempts, but 3 out of 40 is still much better shot at unlocking this than 3 out of 10,000. So, and the nice thing is you don't even need to take these power traces. It's cute to show on the screen, but I can just time the algorithm. It just takes longer. So if I start my clock when I send the pin unlock command, I stop my clock when I get the answer back, I can just see the time increase with the number of digits I get right. So, this shows you, well, this is a timing attack or an SPA attack if you do it based on the traces, and it can really give some information about what's going on the inside. So here with nice red boxes. So SPA is what we call symbol power analysis. That's because we're not using any statistics, basically. Once we start using statistics and many more traces, we call it differential power analysis. Just as the definition. So we've already more or less done this in the trace this morning as well, but you can recognize usually repetitions from these traces. So this one actually has, you see between 225 and 245, I'll give you the number of rounds there. That's actually 16 that you see. And if you see 16 rounds, of course, you all shout out, that's death, Jasper. Then you would be correct. Because the title also says it in the trace. But you can do more interesting things. So if you take many of these traces, you can start looking at the differences of power consumption, and specifically the differences that are caused by sending different data. Because if I run the same desk process over and over again, but I give it different data, then the only difference between those processes should be caused by the data, at least if there's no countermeasures, plus noise, of course. So that's the more the statistical way of looking at this, and that's when you get into the differential space and the t-testing and things of that nature. Just to zoom in and show you a little bit what that looks like. So this is actually the start of a software DES, again, a long time ago when we created these pictures. This card actually leaks something that we like to call the Hamming weight, which is basically, in a data value that it's operating on, it's a number of bits that are set to 1. You just count them. And what happens if this card processes values with more bits set to 1, it will actually consume more power. And the nice thing about this one is that you can actually see it in single traces. I'll zoom in a little bit. So this is the view where between 0 and 4 on the x-axis, that's actually the initial permutation, which is the first step in DES. And then you see this repeated pattern. So from 5 to about 14, that's one round, and then it repeats. So there's about 3 rounds in this picture before it gets cut off. But let's zoom into this a little bit further. So here you're starting to see the clock cycle level. So remember I mentioned that you see these peaks coming up regularly. That's what you're starting to see here. And if you now overlap 16 of these traces, you can start seeing that in some places there really are nicely overlapped, and in some places you just get this harmonica. And that's because I send this different plain text. So it's the same desk process, just different data it's operating on. And it's very obvious. So in the middle, or roughly there, you see really it spreads out, which is caused by those different data values. And to the left, there's a little bit of noise there. So you get that as well. So this is an example of when it's really bad. If I can visually see things spread out, that means the signal is so clear, it's above the noise level. So anything modern and anything that has sensible countermeasures, you shouldn't be able to see this. And that's why you need the statistics. So you actually need to pull the signal out of the noise. But I thought this was a nice example just to, you know, set it in your mind of what's actually happening down at the gates and at the power consumption level, which directly relates to, you know, data that I'm sending. So it's really a low-level thing that we're grasping. We're connecting it directly to data and later to key material as well. This is another interesting example where there's actually 2 traces here, blue and green. I hope you're not colorblind. In the beginning part, so the fourth until about the third of this picture, these 2 traces are perfectly overlapped. And to the right, you see something happening, like a shift almost. It's like one got some kind of insertion and then started doing something similar, but just a little bit later. I can talk long about this trace as well, because it's actually really interesting. But the bottom line is this was a COMP128, which is a GSM algorithm, which has 9-bit table lookups. So it has tables, just like a lot of crypto algorithms, 9-bit tables with 512 entries. But this was running on an 8-bit microcontroller. So what the compiler actually did is it split this 9-bit table up into 2 8-bit tables. And then, based on the highest bit, it would select one of the tables and then index in it. But there was actually a timing leak there, depending on which table it went to. And this was actually dependent on a value that we sent to the algorithm, so it's data controlled by the attacker, plus the key. So if I combine those 2, it would go to the selection of these 2 tables. So now, turning that whole thing around, if I can see in which table I am, and I know the data, I can actually calculate what the key was. So just from seeing these kind of things, you can really relate back to key material. So there's a bunch of different things that are going on here. So we have, when we're measuring the power of a device, it's not just the leakage. It's a sum of all kinds of interesting things and non-interesting things. So we have the kind of the constant power that the device takes, which is not so interesting. It's like the 12 volt or the 5 volt or the 3.3 volt that you're familiar with. Then there's just electrical noise, which is picking up out of the environment. It's noise to us as well as an attacker because it's not interesting. And then we have two bits that are interesting. So the data dependent power consumption, so that was the Hemingway leakage we were seeing earlier, and the operation dependent power leakage. So if it's doing some kind of timing difference or that relates to the keys, that's also interesting. So top part there is irrelevant. The electrical noise as an attacker or as a lab, we want to minimize. The data dependent we want to maximize, and the operation dependent we also want to maximize. So this is where all kinds of filtering and those kind of techniques come in to split the noise from the signal as much as you can. Actually, I'm going to skip this. So conceptually, you can imagine that noise actually per signal information comes from three different levels. So we really have the physical level, which is where transistors are switching, there's capacitances, all kinds of things happening, just with the physics of the chip. And at the clock cycle level, we can see things like instruction profiles. So it's actually, there's some papers out there which show that different instructions being executed by a CPU show slightly different power profiles. So you can actually, not 100% accurately, but you can kind of see what instructions are being executed if you know what those power profiles for those instructions look like. Data profile we've seen, so there's a relation between the power consumption and the data values that are being processed. And then at the higher level, you can look at the entire process. So if there's not constant time, different paths that are being taken in the code, or even data and signal dependencies that occur. So all these things cause information leakage. Any questions so far? Is this for you guys, I mean, just to check, am I going too deep or not deep enough, too fast, too slow? But this is what I tell most of my clients as well. All of these attacks have certain assumptions. If you break those assumptions, the attack doesn't work anymore. So, for instance, in the earlier attack, I was assuming that. Let's assume I have this. So, as an attacker, I can say, "Hey." That Hamming weight, that actually is an assumption that an attacker has to make at some point. So if you either don't leak the Hamming weight anymore or you leak something that looks like Hamming weight, I'm going to be going down the wrong road. I'm not going to find what I'm looking for. So I'm not explicitly for each attack going to say, like, this is how you put a countermeasure in. But for each of these things, there's a way to prevent it. And then there's another way for me to come up with another attack, and another way for you to prevent that. And that's how we're still all in business, I guess. Does that more or less answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, hopefully you also know that when you look at your how you balance that, you know, with your constrained by power.
Yeah.
What are the balances and trade-offs you make as you look at this?
Yeah, it's one of the tricky things with side channel is you don't really know what the leakage is till you have a physical implementation. So, I mean, our customers struggle with this all the time, right? Because they design a chip, they put in a bunch of countermeasures, kind of hoping that at least a few of them stick. And then you go to tape out, you go to silicon, you do tests, and then you can figure out whether some work and whether others don't work. But it really is kind of an iterative process. We're trying, and this is really more like research right now, so we're not sure if it's going to work, but doing power simulations of circuits, and then trying to figure out if countermeasures in those simulations actually help to address these kind of issues. But yeah, we don't have results on that part yet. So your question about balancing, that even makes the equation harder, right? Because then you have more constraints to consider. It's also not my expertise, to be honest with you, right? I just attack the stuff, I don't design it. Usually project budgets and stuff are things to balance in as well, production costs. Sometimes countermeasures will give you more failures in the field. You know, there's actually a lot of aspects there to consider. Any other questions so far? Okay, so let's focus not so much on the power traces itself, but on the tools that we can use to get power out of the system. So this is kind of an overview of what I have on the desk here. So the flow is really that I have a PC, which is sending plain text, the device is doing some crypto on it, and it's sending me the ciphertext. So there's just an I/O channel there. Then the device we have hooked up, in this case, not with a current probe, but an electromagnetic probe, not a big difference, to an oscilloscope. That oscilloscope captures the data and sends it all back to the central computer. And that's where you have the match between the plain text, ciphertext, and the trace. And that's the basic stuff you need to do your analysis on. So to just show you how we do this when we are using an inductive probe. So if we have some kind of chip, we typically actually cut the power supply to it and route it through a probe. So we can actually measure the power consumption quite directly. The nice thing about this is you don't get so much environmental noise. So you're actually getting a nice signal from the device. But it does mean sometimes that you have to cut things on a PCB and do some soldering. It's not rocket science, but you need to actually be at the device, modify it. And you can break it, especially if I'm the one doing the soldering. It's not good. This is more the setup that we have here. So you see the board that we have at the bottom there. On the left is the I/O. The top you see the EM probe. And then on the right hand side we have this trigger signal, which is basically that signal that tells me the crypto is happening now, which under lab circumstances is kind of the default setting. If you're doing this as an attacker, you don't have that. So there's one extra step for you to kind of find when the crypto is happening, which really depends on the device if that's going to be a 5-minute effort or a 5-day effort. If you see 10 rounds like we did before, it's not going to be so hard. If it's a hardware crypto thing, you're going to have to do a little bit more to figure out when that's happening. So one nice thing about EM, well, it's a mixed blessing, I guess, is that you have also different positions over the chip where you can measure the electromagnetic field. So when there's really a big dependence on where you're measuring over the chip versus the amount of leakage, you're going to have to sample different points over the chip, figure out where the leakage is the strongest. Now, we don't do that actually. When we started doing this, we did it manually. So you just look on the scope and move your probe until you see something that you like. which is more of an art form at that point than science. But still effective, actually, interestingly. But if you want to do a more thorough scan, we just have a stage that moves the probe over the surface, and you do the same experiments over and over again, but you just measure at different points on the chip. And then you get some information on where the leakage is strongest. Here's actually a 3D plot of the X and the Y axis are actually the chip surface itself, so different locations. And the Z axis and the color is the amount of signal coming from that particular point. And this is a chip that was, I believe, it was about 2 by 2 millimeters. So it's quite a small chip. And we divided it up into 20 by 20 spots. So about 0.1 millimeter or 100 microns per step. And you see that there's actually quite a significant difference between some of these steps. So the positioning, you know, going back to your earlier question, position can really make a big difference. Depending on the target and depending on what you're actually doing. There's a few other nice things. So when this whole game got started, people started doing power analysis mostly in the late 90s. So they would just consider the complete power consumption of the entire device. And as a countermeasure, here's one, they put in a noise generator on the power line. So this is something that arbitrarily consumes noise. So it really fuzzes out whatever you're measuring. The nice thing is about EM is that you have this positional axis as well. So instead of putting your EM probe over the part that makes the noise, you put it over the crypto processor and get the signal from there. So that really helps you to get better signal out. Of course, the downside is you have to find the crypto processor. So you can do that optically by looking at dye pictures if you're good, or you can do a scan and check again where you're seeing some kind of leakage. Sometimes it's actually not feasible to do a power tap, either because the board modifications are really tricky, or you have like a contactless smart card. It's hard to make a power tap there because it has no contact. And then EM is also a good way of approaching that. So just a quick show of what EM and current look like when you start measuring that. So when you're taking a EM measurement at the top there, so I mentioned earlier it's the derivative of the power signal. So basically if you have a power signal which does that spike pattern, you'll actually see the EM go spike up and then negative and then it will go back. So you see that at the top, instead of one spike, you see it go positive and then negative and then it flattens out. If I make this artificially into a power signal by doing the integration, you can start seeing these individual spikes again. The nice thing about this picture is we did a two-channel measurement. So we're actually looking at the power consumption at the same time as we're doing the EM measurement. And then you can compare the two signals. So what you're seeing in the middle one, you're actually getting a lot more detail in your measurement than in the bottom trace. So it looks much more like a low frequency signal. So EM is a bit more sensitive to the high frequencies. So a little bit about the board that we have here. So we call it internally the piñata board because we're hammering it all the time, basically, until the keys fall out. This is not so interesting, but we're using an FTDI cable to communicate with it. We have one probe point for the trigger, power supply. It's basically a high-end Cortex-M4, which is an ARM CPU. It does have hardware crypto support, so it does have AX accelerators and everything, which we're not using today because it would take too long. So we designed this as a more or less realistic training target. So we're using this internally also for our training. We typically measure the power consumption at this 3.3 volt pin. So we get a nice power signal there. Today we're using the EM. And we actually prepared the board in such a way that we don't need to put an amplifier even in the power signal. So it's really nice and loud. I suggest before we go into this, we take a 3-minute bio break, because I know I need one. I'm drinking a lot of this.